In the contemporary context of a war on obesity, so-called, sport and physical activity are habitually cited as an essential element in the declared fight against fat. And this is a proposal guided by the assumption that fatness and health and fitness are mutually exclusive, or at best that one is a cure for the other, which is seen in the Olympics Legacy Action Plan, for example, where sport has been officially sort of labelled as a means of fighting fat. And so from this perspective then, the fat body cannot be a sporting body, not least because socially privileged traits such as self-discipline are strongly associated with the production of sporting bodies but are conventionally treated as antithetical to fatness. So what does this mean then for the sport of marathon swimming, which actively demands the acquisition or minimally the maintenance of body fat as a performance advantage? How are legitimate sporting identities constructed, contested, and embodied in such a seemingly paradoxical context? Marathon swimming refers broadly to open water swims of 10 kilometres and over, and the Olympic event is a 10-kilometre event. But I'm looking at what might be considered to be the ultra domain of marathon swimming. So in iconic terms, this is represented by the English Channel, which is 21 miles across at its shortest point, with an average crossing time of about 13 and a half hours. But this might also include other long swims, such as the Catalina Channel, which is in LA. It's from last summer. It's my swim there. And that's a very standard sort of English Channel crossing chart. This is the big S. So I'm looking at those swims governed by what are called channel rules, which is a kind of nostalgic but modernised nod to the conditions of the first English Channel swims. So this is Captain Matthew Webb, who swam in 1875, and Gertrude Edderley, who was the first woman in 1926. And so the channel rules are where a swimmer can only wear a regular, non-buoyant, non-insulating swimming costume, a latex or silicone cap and goggles, and Webb didn't actually have goggles and his suit was made of wool. So it is a nostalgic nod rather than a sort of strict obeyance to the rule. But it's in this non-wetsuit context that the maintenance and acquisition of body fat becomes a performance necessity alongside other acclimatisation practices. So the seeking out of body fat then makes the marathon swimming body an anomaly among other ideal type sporting bodies. When I first encountered the marathon swimming community as a swimmer and then as a researcher, my initial response as someone coming from within critical obesity studies or fat studies was one of political optimism. The swimming body, I speculated, hopefully, offered a platform for challenging conventional assumptions about the mutual exclusivity of fit and fat that I'd been exploring in other parts of my work. But the reality of swimming fat is much more complicated than my rather naive first assessment. And what I'm arguing in this paper is that while at first glance purposeful swimming fat appears to be a repudiation of conventional values of fitness and fatness, on closer inspection it reveals an approach to body fat that is simultaneously comprised of a profound allegiance to the rhetorics of bodily discipline and control, and antipathy towards fat, and the contingent valuing and celebration of fat, and in some cases actual reappraisal of the fat body. So I'm drawing on a multi-sited, ESRC-funded multi-sited auto-ethnography and ethnography of channel swimming into the process of becoming a channel swimmer, and this is the project website. And it grew. The project grew out of my own decision in 2008 to train to swim the channel, which I eventually did in 2010, but the project has sort of been ongoing nevertheless. So what I want to argue is that the apparently contradictory embrace and repudiation of fat within the swimming community is held together through the concept of heroic fatness. That is, like the brave actor who gains weight for a role, where fatness figures as an undesirable but necessary act of bodily discipline, sacrifice, and suffering in the service of swimming. In this way, then, heroic fatness produces the very same values that it seems to contradict. But it's neither universally available nor achievable, and I want to suggest that this leads to some much more ambivalent forms of fatness. This unsettling that we get of the certainties of heroic fatness provides a productive lens through which to explore the disjunctures and ambiguities between prevailing knowledges and practices about both fatness and sport. So to illustrate some of this complexity, I'm going to look very briefly, firstly, at the construction of heroic fatness, and secondly, at ambivalent fatness that arises out of these disjunctures and exclusions. I'm not going to say any more about the methodology of the project because of time, but I'm happy to answer questions about that. I'm drawing mostly on the ethnographic material here rather than the autoethnographic. So heroic fatness. Although there are considerable uncertainties within the swimming community about how much body fat is enough body fat, a singular certainty emerges within the dominant narrative of swimming that fat is an undesirable necessity. This is encapsulated in the very commonly circulated maxim, you can't be too vain to gain if you want to swim the channel. And you hear this all the time, and of course it already embodies that idea that fatness is kind of aesthetically unpleasing and problematic. Especially for swimmers coming to the sport from other endurance sports like running or Ironman, for example, the concept of purposeful weight gain is an anathema to their sporting identities. So Simon, for example, was an experienced and accomplished endurance athlete and climber whose relatively lean body made him very vulnerable to the cold, which he suffered terribly from this during training and actually had an unsuccessful swim as well. Oh, sorry, that's me swimming the channel. So this is Simon, and he says, the thing is, I was fit enough to swim, but it just seemed so gloriously unfair, and I love that word, unfair, in there, that with swimming it doesn't, it's almost the opposite, because in other sports, the fitter you are, the leaner you are, the more muscular you are equals improved performance. It just seems so alien to me, on the one hand, just banging out as much swim time as possible, but on the other hand, eating 5 donuts a day. And as he was talking to me, he kind of gestured a big round belly and then blew his cheeks out to make a fat face, or like this. There's a moral element to his kind of discomfort, to his disrupted sporting identity, since fatness is commonly associated with having let yourself go, with excess. Heroic fat, then, has to be distinguished from its unheroic counterpart in order to resist this attribution of failure. So on a training camp in Malta, for example, a swimmer pointed out a man who was on holiday with his family, whose rounded stomach hung heavily over the waistband of his shorts. And the swimmer remarked, sort of laughingly, he'd make a good channel swimmer. And everyone laughed. The joke finds its humour in the shared recognition, or presumed shared recognition, that the body fat of the swimmers and the non-swimmers on the beach may be materially similar, but is symbolically different. The non-swimmers have let themselves go, but the swimmers have purposefully made fat happen. This distinction is reliant on the presumption of weight loss once the swim is over. You make it happen, then you make it go away. So it has to be a provisional state to be heroic, incorporating both the acknowledgement of fat as contingently necessary but undesirable and identification with the socially valued traits of self-discipline and bodily control. So as one of the male swimmers told me, this fat is okay because it's not who I am. So for all the monolithic anti-fat rhetoric of the war on obesity then, in fact not all fat is equal or the same. And heroic fatness is very dependent on being able to draw distinctions between fatnesses. So to move on to the idea of ambivalence within this fatness, significantly, the discourse of heroic fatness is the very specific reserve of those who are not fat at the start of the training process. Instead, swimmers who already have sufficient or more than sufficient body fat to swim can never have heroically fat bodies, since being fat and purposefully getting fat and then lean again are symbolically distinct. As one male swimmer in Dover who self-identified as fat commented quietly to me on the beach as we watched a group of young male swimmers loudly slapping and wobbling the recently acquired fat stomach of one of them, it makes you wonder what they must think of me. Heroic fatness is also far less available to women, in part because their bodies are already seen as naturally fat, and also because of the much narrower boundaries of acceptable body size for women. And there is no, I didn't come across any readily available affirmative lexicon for female fatness amongst the swimmers, and certainly none of the physical comedy about the slapping of body fat and so on amongst the women. These exclusions then open up spaces for a much more ambivalent mode of fat embodiment that constitutes, I think, I hope, a quiet challenge to heroic fatness and to the war, the values of the war on obesity. This can be seen, for example, in moments of critical awareness of the variety of body types involved in marathon swimming and the impossibility of reading either performance or health status from body size. As one female swimmer who identified as overweight for large parts of her life noted, my heart rate is really good. My resting heart rate is phenomenal. My blood pressure is low. Well, you know, you swim and swim and swim. I might be fat, noted another, but my body is amazing, just amazing. Look what it can do. These mark a changed awareness of what the fat sporting body could signify beyond constraining dominant narratives of fat as synonymous with ill health and moral failure. Consequently, while these stories often begin with confessions, I know I'm fat, but they are moments of reflexive awareness that highlight the contradictions between the dominant values and the lived experience. And so what I also saw was people then began to reevaluate their own experiences of fatness and of weight management. And this applies particularly to women who are the primary users of weight loss interventions and who have a much more problematic relationship with the fat body conventionally. So Melissa, for example, says, I've been this fat before. She'd gained a lot of weight for a channel swim. She said, I've been this fat before, unhappily so, you know, very unhappily so. So in a depressed state, hating my body. Whereas now, you know, I'm ambivalent about losing it. So it's not really a wholehearted embrace of fatness, but it's a very far cry from her unhappy fatness or heroic fatness. She also said that being able to eat freely whilst training had made her rethink how, she said, obsessed she became with food while she was dieting in the past, and it made her think how problematic that was. And another female swimmer told me how she'd weighed herself every day throughout her adult life and had stopped weighing herself when she gained weight to swim because she couldn't bear to see the numbers going up. But since her swim had not gone back to weighing it every day and described that behaviour as being a bit psycho. So there'd been a change in practice. So what we see is a great deal of ambivalence kind of sneaking in around those very solid narratives that we hear in health policy, for example, around what the fat body means and what we should do to it. And I think you do see these kind of tastes of sort of slightly empowering different ways of thinking about the body. So to conclude, and I've just used this picture, this is the poster that was the headline banner for the National Obesity Forum conference a few years ago, and I think it just shows how much of the war on obesity is about class and is about gender in a very unspoken way, and we see this sort of played out in this specific context as well. So what I've argued is that marathon swimming is comprised of an allegiance to the values of bodily discipline and control, an antipathy towards fat, and the valuing and celebration of fat at the same time, and that these are held together through heroic fatness, where fatness is undesirable, necessary, and bravely but provisionally born before being eliminated. And I've suggested that you get some cracks emerging in the dominant knowledges about fatness and about sport, especially among those who can't fit into the heroic fat narrative. The key implication for me in this is in relation to anti-obesity and sport policy more generally. Most significantly, it shows very clearly that for all of the rhetoric of the war on obesity, not all fat is treated equally, with a very strong moral dimension to categorizations of acceptable and unacceptable fatness. And this matters when individuals and groups are subject to medical and social intervention on the basis of a unifying certainty that fat kills. And related to this, not all fat is experienced equally, but is very uneven and unpredictable, produced in interaction with dominant values, but not determined by them. Marathon swimming is, by any definition, a minority sport, but the normative values that make up the sport are also those of the wider social and cultural context within which it's practiced. And those same values are intensified and made visible by the anomalous sporting embodiment demanded by the sport itself. As such, even while seeming to disregard norms of body size, composition, and practice, marathon swimming speaks directly to those values in ways that challenge how we think about whose bodies count, both as fit bodies and as bodies that fit. Thank you very much.